You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures entitled A Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos, translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 11, given in Dornach on the 15th of July, 1921. Today I will summarize a few truths which will then help us give a direction to what we will cover in the next few days. When we look at our soul life, we can see that there is one pole devoted to our thinking, and that the other contains our will element, and between the two lies the element of feeling, and what we might call our disposition. In our soul experience during the waking condition, we will never find just the one element, thinking or will, at any given time, because they are always in connection with each other, playing into each other. Let us assume that we have a very calm approach to life, so that one could say that our will is outwardly not very much in evidence. We will still have to be quite clear that whilst we are thinking in such moments of calmness, our will is at work in our thinking. As we connect one thought with another, will is at work in our thinking. Thus, even when we are apparently in a purely contemplative state, just thinking, our will is at work within us. Similarly, unless we happen to be raving mad or sleepwalking, our will cannot be active without our will impulses being infused with thoughts. Our will activity is always penetrated by thinking. Thus, our will is likewise never acting alone within our soul life. Nevertheless, what is never acting alone within us can also have a different origin from the other elements of our soul life. The thinking pole within us comes from a totally different source, from our life of will. Even looking at everyday life, we can see that our thinking always relates to what is already present and has its own preconditions. Thinking is usually retrospective. Even when we are anticipating something, when we are thinking of some undertaking that we intend to carry out later with our will, this anticipatory thinking will still be based on experience, which we will use as a guide. This kind of thinking is also reflective. Our will cannot be directed to what is already there. It would otherwise always be too late. Our will can only orient itself toward what is to come, toward the future. In sum, if you give a little thought to the inner aspect of our thinking and to the inner aspect of our will, you will find that even in everyday life, thinking relates more to the past and our will to the future. Our feeling disposition lies between the two of them. Our feelings accompany our thinking. Thoughts can delight us or repel us. Feelings, in turn, guide our will impulses into life. Our feeling, the content of our soul's disposition, stands in the middle between our thinking and our will. Just as these things are hinted at in ordinary life, they are also to be found in the greater scheme of things. There we find that the foundations of our powers of thought, which enable us to think, are laid in the life before our birth, or rather conception. The seeds of all the thought capacity that we are able to unfold in life are to be found already in the little child before us. The child uses these thoughts as guiding forces in developing its body. For the first 7 years leading up to the change of teeth, a child uses these powers of thought as guiding forces with which to build up its body. Thereafter, they emerge gradually as powers of thought in their own right. Prior to that, they have been embedded in us from the moment we embark on our physical earthly lives. Impartial observation will show us that the powers of will emerging in the child have little to do with its thinking capacities. Just look at the wriggling, constantly moving infant in its first few weeks of life, and you will see that this wriggling, chaotically moving quality of the child is the result of its soul and spirit being wrapped in the physical body from its physical surroundings. It is in this physical nature that we gradually develop, from the moment of conception and following our birth, that our powers of will are to be found. And slowly and steadily, this will is captured by the powers of thought that we have brought with us into physical existence. Just observe how the child initially moves its limbs quite randomly out of the natural liveliness of its physical body, and then how, gradually, thinking takes hold of these movements so that they become purposeful. This thinking is pressing and pushing its way into the child's will life, which is completely embedded in the protective embrace within which we live from the moment we are conceived. Its will life is completely contained within it. We could illustrate this in a diagram showing how we bring our thought life with us as we come down from the spiritual world. And there is a diagram. We put our will life in place in the physical body which is given to us by our parents. That is where our will forces are to be found, expressing themselves chaotically. Here are our thought forces, which initially serve as guiding forces, penetrating our will in its physical setting. They fill it with spirit in the right way. We become aware of these will forces when we go through death and into the spiritual world. This time we experience them as highly ordered. We have carried them through the gates of death and into our life in the spirit. During the course of our lives, we will have lost the forces of thought which we bring with us into earthly life. It is different in the case of people who die early, but for the present we shall focus on the normal person. A normal individual who has lived beyond their 50s will already have lost the real forces of thought which they had brought with them from life before birth, and will have kept the direction-giving powers of will, which are then carried over through death into the life we embark on as we pass through the gate of death. It can be assumed that people will now be thinking, quote, "So we will have lost our powers of thinking after we reach 50 years old?" Close quote. In a sense, this is absolutely true of most people today who have shown no interest in spiritual matters. I would urge you to make a point of noticing how many original, authentic thought impulses have come from people today who are over 50. Generally, it is the automatic thought processes, rolling on from previous years, which have imprinted themselves on our body, and which then automatically keeps them going. It is, after all, an image of our life of thought, and we tend to carry on with the old thought processes according to the law of inertia. There is hardly any other way today of protecting oneself from the treadmill of these old thoughts running on than by taking up thoughts of a spiritual nature during our lifetime, which are similar to those forces of thinking in which we were immersed before our birth. The consequence is that the time is drawing ever closer when older people will be mere automata, unless they take the trouble to engage with the forces of thinking that have a supersensible origin. Of course, we can continue to think automatically, and even look as if we were being actively thoughtful. It is, however, only an automatic movement of the organs in which the thoughts have embedded themselves or woven themselves, unless we are gripped by the youthful element that comes when we engage with thoughts deriving from spiritual science. This is by no means a theoretical activity, but one that has quite a deep effect on our lives. It becomes particularly significant when we consider our relationship to the world around us. By the world around us, I mean everything that reaches our senses between waking up and falling asleep. One could look at it like this. One could cast an eye EYE, a spiritual eye, I mean, over what it is that we see. We call it the veil of the senses. I'll illustrate it in a diagram like this. There's a diagram. Behind everything that we see, hear, experience as warmth, the colors of nature, etc., I shall now draw an eye, EYE, to represent what is perceived. Behind this veil of the senses, there is something definite. Physicists or people with our current perspective on things will say, quote, there are atoms whirling about behind what we see, and then there is no veil of the senses, but somehow these atoms call forth colors and sounds in our eye or our brain. Close quote. Now, imagine that you start thinking quite dispassionately about this veil of the senses. Once you have started to think about it, and if you don't fall prey to the illusion that you could determine this gigantic army of atoms disposed in military array by chemists, let us say, for example, there is NCO, C, then two privates, C, O, O, and then another private, H. You see, then we have them all arranged in military order, ether, atoms, and so on. Now, if we do not succumb to this illusion, but stick with reality, we will know. The veil of the senses is spread out before us. There are the different qualities of the senses, and what I can grasp of what lies within these sensory qualities with my consciousness is essentially thoughts. In reality, there is nothing behind this veil of the senses other than thoughts. What I mean is that behind the phenomena of the physical world, you will find nothing but thoughts. We shall talk about the fact that these are carried by beings later. It is, however, only with our thinking that we can get behind what we find in the physical world. The power of this thinking is something we have brought with us from our life before conception. Why is it, then, that we penetrate through this veil of the senses with this power of thought? Let us try to become really familiar with the thought process I have just embarked on, and try to set out the question on the basis of what we have just indicated and in the context of our studies to date. How is it that we are able to reach behind the veil of the senses with our thoughts, if these thoughts come to us from our life before birth? It is very straightforward, because what lies behind it is not in the present, but in the past. It belongs to the past. What lies behind the veil of the senses is, in fact, of the past, and our view of it is only correct if we recognize it as from the past. The past works on into our present, and what we see in the present is sprouting up toward us out of the past. Imagine a meadow covered in flowers. You see the grass as a green covering, and you see the flowery decoration of the meadow. That is all in the present, but it is growing up out of the past. If you think that through in detail, what you will have is not an atomistic present, but the past as an underlying reality which is related to that part of you which has its origins in the past. It is interesting. When we begin to reflect, the world that is revealed to us is not the present, but is the past that reveals itself. What is the present? The present has no logical structure at all. A ray of sunshine falls on the flower and gleams there. The next moment, when the ray of sunshine has changed direction, it gleams in another direction. The picture changes from moment to moment. The present is such that we cannot grasp it with mathematics, nor with thought constructs. What we can grasp with the structures of our thinking is the past, working on into the present. This is something that can reveal itself to us as a great and significant truth. When you are thinking, what you think is essentially only the past. If you are weaving logical thought structures, you are basically only thinking about what is past. If you can grasp this thought, you will no longer look for marvels in the past. For whilst the past is weaving its way into the present, it must remain as it was in the past, even in the present. Just think, if you had eaten cherries yesterday, it was an action in the past. You cannot change the fact that it has happened, because it is a past action. But if the cherries were in the habit of leaving a sign somewhere, before they disappeared into your mouth, this sign would remain. You could do nothing to change this sign. Now, if every cherry had registered its past in your mouth after you had eaten cherries yesterday, and someone came along and wanted to cross out 5 of them, he would be able to cross them out. But the fact of the matter would not change. Similarly, there is no way in which you could produce any kind of miracle out of natural phenomena, since they are all reaching into the present from the past. Everything that we can grasp with the laws of nature is already in the past. It no longer has anything of the present about it. The present can only be grasped by means of images. It is fluctuating by nature. If a body lights up here, a shadow will arise. You have somehow to allow the shadow to determine its own contours. You can construct the shadow. For the shadow to arise in reality, you have to devote yourself to a study of the image. So we can conclude, even in ordinary life, setting boundaries, I could also say logical thinking, relates to the past. Imagination, on the other hand, relates to the present. We always have imaginations in relation to the present. Just think how it would be if you wanted to live in the present logically. It's true, isn't it? Living logically means developing one concept out of another, following strict laws from one concept to the next. Now place yourself back in real life. You see one event. Is the one that follows it logically connected with it? Can you deduce the next event logically from the previous one? If you look at life as a whole, are not the images within it similar to a dream? The present is similar to a dream, and it is only the fact that the past gets involved in the present that gives the present its lawful, logical structure. If you want to divine anything of the future in the present, even if you want to think of something that you intend to do in the future, then initially nothing concrete happens inside you at all. What you will experience this evening is not there as an image within you, but as something even less substantial than an image. At best, it will be an inspiration. Inspirations relate to the future. Logical thinking, past. Imagination, present. Inspiration, future. We can clarify what is meant in the form of a simple diagram. I'll represent the human being in this I, EYE, and as we look at the veil of the senses, we see it in its constantly changing images. Now we introduce laws into this world of changing images. A specific science emerges. Now consider how this science is developed. We research and we do so by thinking. If the aim is to develop a science of what is manifesting in the veil of the senses, a science that is based on logical thought, you will find it impossible to derive these logical thought processes from the outer world itself. If the thoughts underlying the laws of nature, and the laws of nature are, after all, also thoughts, emerged from the outer world itself, it would not be necessary to learn anything about the outer world. Anyone looking at that light over there would have as precise an understanding of the laws of electricity, etc., as the person who had studied them. Similarly, unless you have learned the relationship of the radius to the circumference, you are unable to say anything about it. The thoughts that we transfer to the outer world emerge from within us. That is how it is. The thoughts that we carry into the world around us are brought with us from our own inner life. We ourselves are the human being who is built as a head person. This person looks at the veil of the senses. Within the veil of the senses itself lives what we are able to reach with our thinking, and there's a diagram, and between that and what we are unable to perceive lying within us, there is a kind of underground connection. That is how it comes about that what we do not perceive in the outer world, because it links up with what lies within us, is brought out of our own inner life in the form of thoughts, which we then bring out and project into the outer world. Counting would be a good example of this. The outer world does not do any counting for us, but laws of number lie within us. This is due to there being an underground or subcorporeal connection between what is to be found in the outer world and the earthly laws that apply to ourselves. That is how we produce numbers from within ourselves. They also match what is outside us. The pathway linking them does not, however, go through our eyes or any of our senses, but through our organism. Our whole human constitution is thus involved in our learning process. It is not true to say that we grasp any natural law by means of our senses. We grasp it with the whole of our human nature. These are the things we have to take into account if we wish to acquaint our inner feeling disposition rightly with how we stand in relation to the outer world. We are constantly immersed in imaginations. And all we need to do is to draw an unprejudiced comparison between everyday life and a dream. While the dream is in progress, it certainly behaves quite chaotically, but is nevertheless much closer to real life than logical thinking. Let us take an extreme example. I'm assuming a conversation between two sensible people of our time. You are listening in and can contribute to the conversation. Now, consider the context of a half-hour conversation in terms of its coherence from the perspective of a dream sequence, or from the perspective of its logical sequence. If you are expecting a logical sequence to emerge, you would probably be rather disappointed. The world of our time clearly reaches us in the form of images, with the result that we are basically constantly dreaming. If we want logic, it has to be introduced. We wrest logic from our pre-birthly state. We first of all connect it with the things around us, and then in doing so encounter the past in these things. The present we access through our imaginations. If we take a look at this imaginative life that constantly surrounds us, we can say, it is given to us. We have to make no effort of our own to access it. Now, just think how much effort you have had to put into acquiring logical thinking. There will have been no need to exert yourself to enjoy life or to contemplate it. It reveals itself to you of its own accord. So we are well served in ordinary life in terms of how our surroundings reveal themselves to us in pictures. All we need now is to acquire the capacity to form pictures out of our own inner activity, as we otherwise would do with our thinking. Then we would not only see our surroundings in picture form, but would extend this pictorial consciousness into our life before we were conceived. Once we can perceive that in the form of images, our thinking will become populated by these images, and our life before we were born will become a reality. By developing the faculties I describe in my title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, we can become accustomed to thinking in pictures without these pictures presenting themselves to us involuntarily in the way they do in everyday life. If we can turn the world of images in which we live in ordinary life into our own inner life, we shall be looking into the spiritual world, and we will see how our life truly unfolds. Today it is regarded, largely without exception, as spiritual if someone despises material life and says, quote, I am striving toward the spirit and matter is far beneath me, close quote. That is a weakness. For one will only attain a spiritual life if one does not have to leave matter behind but can see it in the spiritual aspect of its activity. One will need to see all matter as spiritual in its origin, and likewise recognize everything spiritual in its material manifestation. This will be particularly significant when we come to look at thinking and willing. There remains only language, which after all contains a hidden genius, that has something of the quality within it which can lead to knowledge in this field. Let us look at the foundations of our will activity in ordinary life. You will know that it is initiated by desire. Even the most ideal aspiration of the will begins in desire. Now let us take the most basic manifestation of desire, which is hunger. We can deduce that everything that stems from desire is essentially linked to hunger. From what I shall be indicating today, you will gather that the opposite pole is thinking, which will therefore work in the opposite way to desire. What we can say then is that if we recognize desire as the foundation of will, it will be satisfaction that underlies thinking, satisfaction as opposed to hunger. The facts correspond to this at the deepest level. If you take the human head organization and the other organization that hangs from it, the fact is that we perceive. What exactly does this mean? We perceive through our senses. As we do our perceiving, something is constantly being worn away in us. Something comes from outside into what is inside us. The ray of light that penetrates into our eye actually wears something down inside us. It is as if a hole is being drilled into our material substance. See the diagram on page 166. Where there used to be matter, a ray of light has now drilled a hole. Now there is hunger. This hunger must be appeased, and it is appeased out of the organism by the available nutrients. That is, this hole is refilled by the nutrients that lie within us. Now we have thought. We have thought what we have perceived. As we think, we are constantly filling up the holes that sense impressions have made in our substance with a satisfaction that arises out of our organism. It is fascinating to observe what happens in our head organization when we place matter from the rest of our organism into the holes that arise through our ears, our eyes, our sense of warmth, etc. As we think, we completely refill the holes that have been drilled into us. It is similar when we exert our will. The difference is that it is not holes being drilled into us from outside, but what is coming from within. When we exert our will, hollow spaces arise in us everywhere. These must likewise be filled up with matter. So there are negative effects, hollowing us out, coming both from outside and within us, which have constantly to be filled up by our own material substance. It is these extremely subtle effects, these hollowing out activities, that actually destroy our whole earthly existence. As we receive the ray of light or hear the sound, we are destroying our whole existence on earth. Of course, we react to it and replace what has been destroyed with earthly substance. Our lives are thus spent between the destruction of our earthly existence and its replacement, luciferic, aramonic. The luciferic element is constantly trying to make something partially non-material out of us, to lift us completely out of our earthly existence, If he could, Lucifer would like to completely spiritualize us, that is, dematerialize us. But Ahriman is his opponent. He ensures that everything that Lucifer hollows out is filled back in again. Ahriman is the continual refiller. If you were going to make a sculpture of Lucifer and make Ahriman capable of being molded into shape, and the substances used could blend with each other, you could very well press Ahriman into the hollows created by Lucifer or cover them over with Lucifer. Since there are also hollow spaces within, one would have to fill these in too. Ahriman and Lucifer are the opposing forces at work within us. We ourselves must hold the balance. Lucifer, with his constant dematerializing processes, results in Ahriman, who is constantly rematerializing. When we perceive something at work, it is Lucifer. When we reflect on what we have perceived, Ahriman. If we have the idea that we should wish for this or that, Lucifer. If we really wish to realize something on earth, Ahriman. That is how we are placed between the two. We swing between the two of them and need to be aware that we are positioned in the most intimate way between Ahrimanic and Luciferic elements. We can really only understand ourselves once we take this polarity within us into account. This is an approach that is neither purely abstract nor spiritual, for abstract spirituality is nebulous mysticism, not purely materialistic. Everything that has a material effect is simultaneously spiritual. We are always with the spirit. We can see through matter and its effects by seeing how the spirit is everywhere at work within it. Imagination always comes toward us in the present of its own accord. If we artificially develop imagination, we are looking into the past. If we develop the power of inspiration, we are gazing into the future, rather in the way that one can predict solar eclipses or lunar eclipses, as opposed to delving down into every detail. We can see the overarching laws at work in the future on a higher level. Intuition encompasses all three faculties. We are, in fact, constantly subject to the power of intuition, but sleep through it. When we are asleep, our I and astral body are completely within the embrace of the world outside us. There we exercise the intuitive activity which we would otherwise have to carry out consciously with the faculty of intuition. At present, our organization is too weak to allow us to be conscious when we are intuiting. However, we do in fact intuit during the night. Thus, during sleep, we intuit. And in the waking state, we exercise logical thinking, up to a point, of course. Between these two states, we have inspiration and imagination. As we emerge from sleep into waking consciousness, our I and astral body enter into our physical and etheric bodies. What we bring with us is inspiration. So, during sleep, we are in an intuitive state. While awake, we make use of logical thinking. As we wake up, we bring with us inspiration. And as we fall asleep, imagination. You can see then that the higher cognitive faculties are not remote from everyday life, but are present every day. They do, however, have to be raised into consciousness if we wish to develop higher knowledge. We have to remind ourselves again and again that in the last 3 or 4 centuries, natural science has accumulated a huge number of purely material facts and has ordered them into laws. These facts have in turn to be penetrated by the spirit. However paradoxical it may sound, it is good that materialism came about, since we would otherwise have fallen prey to nebulous ways of thinking and would eventually have lost all connection with our earthly existence. When materialism came about in the 15th century, humanity was on the brink of succumbing to luciferic influences and so had become increasingly hollowed out. Then followed the Ahrimanic influence, and in the last 4 to 5 centuries, they have reached a kind of peak. Today they have become very strong, and the danger is that they overshoot the mark unless we confront them with what deprives them of their energy, unless we confront them with what is spiritual. It then becomes important to develop the right feeling for the relationship of the spirit to matter. There is a poem from ancient German culture which was entitled Muspeli. It was first discovered in a book that was dedicated to Louis the German in the 9th century, though it had much earlier origins. This poem contains something essentially Christian. It depicts the battle between Elias and the Antichrist, and is reminiscent of the battles depicted in the ancient sagas between the inhabitants of Asgard and those of Jotunheim, the kingdom of the giants. All that has happened is that the kingdom of the Aesir has been transformed into Elias, and the kingdom of the giants into that of the Antichrist. The way of thinking that we meet in this poem obscures the true facts less than later ways of thinking. Later worldviews always represent things in terms of a duality between good and evil, God and the devil, and so on. These do not, however, correspond to the earlier perspective. The people portrayed in the battle between the home of the gods and the home of the giants did not have the same view of the gods as a Christian of today would have of the kingdom of God. Instead, these older ideas placed Asgard, the kingdom of the gods, above, and Jotunheim, the kingdom of the giants, below. Between these was the realm of human beings, Midgard. That is simply a Germanic European portrayal of what is found in the ancient Persian Ormuzd and Ahriman. In our terms, that would correspond to Lucifer and Ahriman. We would have to speak of Ormuzd as Lucifer, and not simply as the good God. The great error that we make is in portraying this dualism as if Ormuzd were merely the good God and his opponent Ahriman the bad one. Their relationship is much more like that of Lucifer to Ahriman. In Midgard, at the time this poem was composed, the picture was not yet fully clear. Christ lets his blood ray downward. In this case, however, it is Elias who lets his blood ray down from above. The place of the human being lies between them. At the time Louis the German probably wrote this into his book, the idea was more correct than the later one. Later on, people had the strange idea of ignoring the Holy Trinity. This meant considering the higher gods who live in Asgard and the lower gods, the giants, who are in the Ahrimanic realm, as the entirety of the cosmos, with the higher gods, the luciferic ones, considered the good ones, and the others the bad ones. This idea came to be accepted later. The earlier view of the opposition of Lucifer and Ahriman was correct, and thus placed Elias with his emotional prophecy, and what he was able to announce at the time in the Luciferic kingdom, for the reason that it was intended to place Christ in Midgard, in the Middle Kingdom. We shall have to return to these ideas in full consciousness, or if we continue to speak only of the duality of God and the devil, we shall not be able to return to the Trinity, the Luciferic gods, the Ahrimanic powers, and between them what belongs to the realm of Christ. Unless we are able to progress to that view, we shall not be able to come to a true understanding of the world. Just think, therein lies the profound secret of how European civilization developed historically. The ancient Ormuzd was turned into the good God, whilst he was actually a luciferic power, a light-bearer. This did, admittedly, give people the satisfaction of tarnishing the name of Lucifer as much as possible, since the name Lucifer did not seem to fit the figure of Ormuzd. It was transferred to Ahriman, turned into a hotchpotch, which still worked on in Goethe's portrayal of Mephistopheles, where Lucifer and Ahriman are once again muddled one with another, as I spelled out in my little book on Goethe's Geistesart, titled Goethe's Spiritual Signature. The European peoples and their civilization as we see them today have got into a state of great confusion, which is inevitably reflected in all their thinking. This can only be redressed by leading people out of this duality back into the Trinity. For all dualism is bound to result in a polarity that allows no space for humanity. What is needed is the prospect of finding a polarity within which we can hold the balance. Christ holding the balance between Lucifer and Ahriman, between Ormuzd and Ahriman, and so on. This was the topic I wanted to broach and which we shall be able to develop with its various ramifications in the days to come. The end of Lecture 11.